Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and we've created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com and please sign up to our newsletter, ensuring you won't miss a show release. You can also access more information on the topics covered, related recommendations, partnerships and collaborations that might appeal. You can follow us on all the social media platforms. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to announce our first sponsorship with Bremont, an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers, designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch, brought to you by our title partner, the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont. Napoleon Bonaparte once said, "China is a sleeping giant. Let her sleep, for when she wakes, she will shake the world." 200 years later, Napoleon was right. China is more than on the move. She's front and center stage in politics, economic power, wealth creation, and possibly at the foothills of a climb to one of the largest stock markets of the future. So our conversation today is about equity investing in China, and intriguingly with one of China's new breed of successful asset managers. So I'm delighted to welcome our guest, Qingxiao Chao, who is affectionately known as Qing, the founder of Redgate Asset Manager, a billion-dollar equity manager. Qing, welcome to you today.
Thank you, Simon.
Let's rewind, if we may, and I'd like you just to share a little bit of your childhood and your upbringing.
I'm Chinese. I was born in Beijing, and I was actually raised by my grandparents. My parents met at school. They married very young. All of a sudden, they had a screaming kid. So they decided to farm me and to be with my grandparents. And that's where I grew up with, in Beijing and being with my grandparents.
And we fast forward, you obviously succeed at school, and then it comes to university. And how did you think about that? Because rather surprisingly, I understand you studied English, but tell me about your choice of university and the topic.
I would go back a little bit further about my grandfather. He comes from a very, very poor family in Chengdu, five kids, and they were so poor, they could only afford to send one kid to school. So his brother went, and he and his other siblings was actually standing outside his brother's classroom, learning for 5 years to graduate a primary school. They all did that, standing outside a classroom for 5 years. So in the end, cut the story short, in the end, they all went to universities. They even went abroad by winning the box indemnity program from US. And he went to Stanford. His brothers went to Columbia and University of Michigan. So education is an important part of my family. And I was born in the 60s. And when I was growing up, Cultural Revolution happened. Then all of a sudden, university was suspended for 10 years. So I was already making up my mind I didn't want to go to university since there was no university to go. Even if there were universities, my mind wasn't set up to go to universities. But in 1977, all of a sudden, Deng Xiaoping resumed the university entrance exam after 10 years, 10 to 12 years. All of a sudden, I had a chance to apply to universities. So I chose a very good business school. I chose their English department. And on the ground that I can read English literatures, I can continue my reading and writing. in the university. And that's how I started.
Wow, that's a fantastic story. Thank you for sharing it. But that still doesn't mean it was obvious we were going to go to finance. So how did finance suddenly get onto your center stage?
When I was graduating, somebody said, why don't you go for an interview? He said, you speak very good English. So I went for an interview, and the company was called Barings. Baring was the oldest merchant bank in London. And every year they select graduate trainees around the world, and they decided to pick one from China. And that was in 1986. The guy, I still remember his name, I've lost contact with him, Nigel Melville. He asked me, do you know anybody in UK? I said, yes, of course. I know William Shakespeare. So for the next, I would say, perhaps half an hour or 20 minutes or even 45 minutes, I went on about my knowledge about William Shakespeare, about his plays, about his poem, about everything. 2 months later, I got an acceptance letter from Barings.
Very prescient, Mr. Melville, to hire you into the organization. But before we jump into your career, I'd like just to pause and talk about China right now. It's the end of November. China's back to life. You're in Shanghai. Disney is open. You can travel. I understand. But please give us a sense of how normal it feels.
I think we are 85% back to where we were before. People are used to it. I used to be measured of your temperature, used to be washing your hand, used to be wearing masks. There was a photo yesterday from my cousin in Beijing. A one-year-old, a baby was wobbling to the security guy and stretched out his arm to be measured of his temperature. People realize it. The government has done a very good job preventing the spread of COVID. And they respect that. They are willing to cooperate in terms of traveling. Domestic flights has resumed 110% in September. Train tickets is difficult to book as my daughter was coming back from Tianjin to Shanghai after quarantine. Of course, people criticize the way the Chinese government has been strong-willed. I look at it and thinking of past 9 months living in Shanghai, it's so important. You either have a quarantine or very strict rules or obey what the government rules and regulations is, and you don't. And I think we did. And the result is we have a human life, and perhaps we don't have a human right, but I would rather be alive than have a human rights.
This, of course, is a debate that we know is going to run. I think that we'd all like here at the moment to be 85%, where we are not, clearly. So let's talk about your investment career. You start at Barings. Tell me a little bit about how you started to acquire the skills that would ultimately lead you to being an investment manager.
My first 15 years with Barings has really set me up as a disciplined, curious, and humble person. And that's how I think I started.
You obviously have a very successful career there. And then in 2000, you leave and you establish Redgate. And today, you and your team manage over $1 billion, and you describe yourself as a boutique Greater China specialist and stock picker. You write that we manage concentrated benchmark agnostic growth-oriented China equity portfolios, which I guess we would just say, put simply, is concentrated equity portfolios. And the business is owned by you and your team who invest alongside their clients. But before we break down your investment process and philosophy, I'd like to just step back and start top down and talk about China's investing landscape and the structural bull story that may exist. If you look at the breakdown of the world stock markets using MSCI allocations, China is, I believe, at 5.5% of the all country weighting, whereas the US today is 58%. So the US is 10 times more than the China weight. Yet, the economies are now a very similar size. You can debate the numbers, but the IMF, adjusting for purchasing power parity has China as actually the larger economy. China's stock markets are small, vastly under-researched, and yet I note that China filed more global patent applications last year than the US. Only 40% of Chinese companies have analyst coverage versus 92% in the US. And the Fortune 500 now contains more Chinese companies than US. So is this a potential gold mine or is it a minefield?
That's a very, very good question. I think for us, it's definitely a gold mine. Otherwise, I won't be sitting here. I really started with a very small objective, setting up Redgate in the year of 2000 with one partner and one secretary. I was desperately looking for independence. Independence is so important. And now, after 20 years, we want to manage money for the best institutions around the world, including Chinese institutions. So for us, to be in Chinese, to be completely bilingual, and to be on this gold mine, it's such a wonderful feeling. But of course, it can be minefield as well. The weightings in MSCI is very low. China is the second biggest economy. At the beginning of 2020, you have a vast population, a huge middle class. Some people say 600 million people. I don't know whether you know much about the history of the Chinese stock market, Simon. Well, in fact, in 1992, Shanghai's stock exchange was first established by CSRC, just under 30 years ago, 28 years ago. Today, we have a total of 6,000 listed companies in China, 4,000 listed onshore in Shanghai, Shenzhen, 2,000 listed in Hong Kong, and ADRs in the United States. It has been a very volatile market. Really, up until 2015, 5-6 years ago, 90% of the trading volumes are retail-oriented. This number has been reduced to 60% in June 2020. Institutional participation is still only 40%. We really just focus on a very small portion of that. We have 120 companies. In the companies we follow aggressively, we have about 60 companies. We really invest into, on the global China basis, about 45 companies. So to answer your second question, it is a minefield if you're not careful, because there are lots of companies who has huge ESG concerns, very, very slow in terms of ESGs. So you really have to look at the gold mine and compare with the universe that you would have.
So let's just drill down a little, if we may. You start with these 6,000 companies. I'd like to understand how you begin the filtering to get to that subset. And then let's talk a little bit about the principles that you've enunciated, of which the first is that we invest with conviction. And I wonder what exactly you mean by that.
So if you ask me 15 years ago, what is our investment philosophy? I would give you 5 pages. Today, our investment philosophy is very simple and repeatable. We invest in quality growth companies. We invest with conviction together with our client at reasonable price. Basically, invest in the companies that can really ride through the different economic cycles. Companies that has a consistent futures earnings growth, generate free cash flows, that has very strong competitive advantage, difficult to replicate, and companies that has honest and reliable management team who are innovative enough. They're normally the leaders of that particular industry. We only invest 25 to 35 names for, we don't want to overpay. So we do look at the valuations very carefully. And we are a strong believer we invest together with our clients. And what benefit our clients would benefit us.
So can you just give us a flavor of a company that you own or or even a sector that has the dynamics that excite you?
I'll pick a share company that we have had it for about 5 years. And we first followed it before it was IPO'd. It has a very simple business model. They are selling stationeries. In China, we have 200 to 240 million K-2 students, children from age 6 to age 18. So they really started as a company of selling papers. But over the past 12 years, they have set up a business that so few people can penetrate. The loyalty is very strong. The brand name is very strong. And the repurchase power is strong. And it's owned by a family, very humble, and has great corporate governors at the back of their mind, and really excellent, excellent consumer names that has been in our portfolio. We hope to hold it. When my grandchildren arrives, we still have a stationery company.
I think those of us who have been in the investing business understand that this is a business that is part science and part art. And one of the advantages that you have versus some other managers, global managers, is you're on the ground. You can just talk about that information advantage and how it helps you in your stock selection.
I congratulate those people who can manage the China portfolio from 10,000 miles away. I can't. I think being on the ground gives us a really significant two advantages. First, the significant information advantage really gives us a firsthand view of consumer habit, the development of market in general, and it provides us some advantage in looking at China such close so that we can make our decisions fast, not make an investment decision, but make a decision on where our research and analysis should be focused. I think this is very important. So that's number one. So number two, passive investing or distance investing, it's really not appropriate for China. I mean, for me, it's not appropriate for anywhere. You really have to be on the ground. Even today, I was telling my kids who was preparing for an interview, I said, just remember, always buy good companies because there are so many bad companies out there. So it's really not just to pick the good companies, but to steer away from us, from those corporate that has problematic business models and corporate that has severe ESG concerns. We cannot tell our clients, well, give us the money, don't worry about it. We have to show them and exactly what we are doing. What we are doing is not just going to visit those companies and tick the ESG boxes. So that's why we feel it's so important to be on the ground.
So I know China's pursuing this dual track policy of continuing to want to grow its exports whilst encouraging the domestic market that is vast. As you invest, do you have a preference or do you look at both the export and the domestic sectors with equal opportunity?
That's also a good question. I know there's excellent export companies who sell textiles to global companies like Nike's, Adidas, the sportswear company. They're very, very well managed and great data, excellent management. So there are one or two companies in that area. We'll look at it. But I would say 99% of our sectors and portfolios are very much domestic consumer driven.
So I listened to your conversation with Norway's sovereign wealth fund. It's the largest wealth fund in the world, managing over $1 trillion. It's on their website. They are invested with you. So clearly you had to undergo intense due diligence to become approved. And what do you think attracted and attracts such deeply professional organizations to your approach?
We don't broadcast our clients, and I'm glad you saw me on the interview. I think this is also one of the reasons you reached me. NBIM has been a client of us for long term, and they have been really a very good client. The largest sovereign wealth fund, they have every single reason to be arrogant, but the NBIM I know as were humble, diligent, professional, and long-term minded. They actually published a book about 20 years of their selecting external managers, and they have a quite simple methodology. My memory is correct. They're looking for people who are curious, humble, willing to change their mind. And I hope we are all of this. And we have learned so much. They are the pioneers on ESGs, and we have learned so much from them in terms of doing well and doing good. That's not easy. They really have this mindset of thinking about financial returns, but also put ESG into perspective in terms of their investment, in terms of their selecting their managers, and I'm just so fortunate.
I'd like to quote Confucius, the great Chinese philosopher, who said that we may learn wisdom by three methods. First, by reflection, the noblest. Second, by imitation, which is the easiest. And third, by experience, which is the bitterest. So, Ching, what's been the most useful mistakes that you've made over the time that you've been an investor?
That's a good question. I'm just trying to reflect in my mind what Confucian has said in Chinese. So I'm sounding a little slow. We're humans. Our mistakes can be attributed in a few ways. For example, we actually underestimated the complication of a business model. The further mistake is not that we realized we made a mistake, but the further mistakes we made was how fast or how slow we have sold. And there are other mistakes, a great business, and we love the company, we love the management, but we sold it, and we sold it because we think it's expensive. And what happened? They've gone up another 100% or another few times. I think a third mistake is just missing a company. I recognize we are a concentrated portfolio, so we will have to miss some of our great companies. We have experienced many, many things in our past 20 years as a fund manager, and we are learning, and we continue to learn.
So that is not just very helpful, but I think it leads to the next question, is there are inevitably multiple traps and pitfalls in investing. So number one, I'm intrigued, what are your red lines? What are the things that will stop you doing more work on a company? And secondly, number of Chinese companies have been center stage wherever they're listing, Luckin Coffee, Tao, IQI. We've had the recent question marks over Ant. And I just wonder how you think about those issues.
Our main purpose, I would say in our 20 years experience, we would definitely avoid companies that has severe ESG concerns, companies that raise debt and equity frequently, companies has inconsistent cash flows, the companies that has much higher gross margins than their competitors. How could this happen? Companies that changing their CFOs, auditors many times, companies that has related party transactions, or companies that has very complicated corporate structures. To answer your question, as an example, I like Alibaba as a group of their innovative nature. They have been absolutely leading the technology innovation 10, 15 years. That's something to be congratulated them with. I think regarding the ends, it's really, I think I put it as a corporate governance or ESG, the listing of the end. So the most profitable business of AND is its petty loan business, lending business. They lend to people on the street, and their 80% of that lending is within 2,000 RMBs. And for people who really needs this, so 80% of that business, and is a business that banks simply couldn't care. They just say, why should we do it? But of course you can do it. So that's how they started. And then they become very, very big. So they ended up arguing with the regulators. That's probably one of the issues. You can dislike some rules and regulations, but you don't really challenge a regulator in a very aggressive way. So the argument that Ant has been with the regulator is that they say, we are not a lending company. We are a platform assistant lending those money out. The regulator comes back and say, look, you are borrowing funds from 400 institutions and lending it and on your platform for a very fat fee because their fee is 46% split of Ant with the banks. So the regulator said, you are a joint loan lender. The argument further is that a lender, your financial institution, you should be regulated and your business scope should be restricted. I look at it really as a positive thing. I think it really sent alarming signal to markets of all the Chinese fintech companies. Number one, the regulatory risks premium, which is largely ignored by all financial, by investors worldwide. And number two, it's really not just for Ant, but for all Chinese fintech companies to respect regulations and to embrace the rules.
Thank you. Well, we've had Neil Fergus on the show talking about the geopolitical tensions that are growing between China and America. I wonder what keeps you awake at night when you're thinking about your portfolio?
I sleep very well, Simon. I tell everybody I sleep very well. Because why shouldn't I? I buy the best companies, have a great team, we have long-term clients, I sleep soundly. I think the harmonious relationship we have witnessed between the two countries is gone. That trust is broken. I love China. I'm biased. I have to love China to do well. I think just to give you an example, China's learned out of the 4 years and at least 2 years, look at in the middle of a tech war, China allowed Tesla to come into China for its renovation. The middle of the trade war, China has allowed Costco to open its only China store in Shanghai. And it also happened to be the biggest store in China for retails. China has not punished Apple in any way, while Huawei has suffered sanctions year in and year out. And I think this is Chinese answer to say, we're not willing to have a war with you. The more war we see it, we're willing to open up for you. And I hope this would be the continued policy of the Chinese government. Did I answer your question?
You did. You answered it very eloquently. A robust defense. Obviously, the Chinese are renowned for loving to gamble. But of course, stock market investing, successful stock market investing, is about long-term conviction and commitment. And I wondered how you think the Chinese retail segment is changing or is thinking about stock market investing as the stock market capitalization expands.
So Chinese loves money. They love making money. They love spending money. They love flashing it out. They love any thought about the money. In Chinese New Year, we give out lai xi. And this red pocket, we say, 恭喜发财. This is not Happy New Year. We're saying, hope you get rich. So this is the way we're greeting each other in the new year. We love money. We're gamblers. If you look at Macau, if you look at all the casinos in the world, you walk in, 50% are Chinese. The stock exchange have a very short history. I would say the first 25 or 20 years, it has really operated like a casino. And I saw so many sad cases that people are gambling away their life savings. And it's very, very sad. And we only see in the past 5 years, the institutions started to moving in and we started to see more rational behaviors. It's a good thing. I hope one day I would be able to have the strength or the capability to manage money for retail, for people on the street, mom and pops, for free. That's really my dream. You know, I would not charge them anything, but long term, I want to make money for them for free. We can't at the moment now, because all the mutual fund license, and to sell it to those retail people, you need to have a mutual fund license. And most are granted to the state-owned enterprises or state-owned asset managers. We are a private fund owned by myself and the management team. So we don't have such a pleasure to do it, but hopefully one day there's a chance we would like very much to bring this long-term investment philosophy. Don't trade too much, no fees or low fees, and to compound the wealth for the generations to come. And that's my dream.
Very good. Well, let's just finish with a few much more general questions. You told me in an earlier conversation that you read 150 to 200 books a year, which is fabulous. And I guess my two questions here are, what do you read and in which language do you read them?
Most of my books, autobiographies or biographies or histories, I use Amazon Audible to listen. I'm saving my eyesight to annual reports. So I don't read that much, but I use Audibles to listen. And I listen in English. It's something I've built up since university. I read in English. A little bit, my mother always says, you're so snobbish. What's wrong with Chinese? There's nothing wrong with Chinese. I just love the tones of pronunciations, the way they use English. I love English literature.
Presumably, Ching, that means that you are a regular listener to the Money Maze podcast.
Absolutely, Simon. Ever since we started the first conversation, I've listened this weekend about 12 fantastic interviews you had. Oh, fantastic. Congratulations. And it's not just the broad topics you have had, and it's also the people you pick. Interesting, and it's really to my taste.
Oh, well, thank you.
Congratulations.
You are now our official ambassador in China. A few other questions. What advice would you give to young folks thinking about starting a career in finance?
It doesn't deviate away from what I believe. You really have to love what you do. You either be an entrepreneur or you go to work for a big company, but you have to have the determination or willingness to succeed. Really to be humble, to be curious, to save money, and to read and write. That's what I do in LinkedIn. I'm writing every day for 1,300 words. And every weekend I write in the Chinese platform as well to answer questions about investment, about life, about everything.
Well, clearly education has been central to you and your family. I think you have two daughters, you sent them to UK independent schools, private schools. And I wondered what it was you thought that those schools in Britain offered that you couldn't get elsewhere.
I went on tours to the US. I went on tours to UK boarding schools. And I left with the impression I think my kids are more suitable for UK boarding schools. They both went in a very good boarding school called Dunhouse. It's a private single-sex girls' school in Berkshire. I'm absolutely pleased they went to Dunhouse because they came back as a complete different person. They are much more independent. They are much more compassionate. I think they love me more. Once they have been there, they know how much their mother cared. And they have also built some very solid friendship. When the girls that Chinese that didn't speak that good language, they can be quite mean. I think they have survived this kind of grow up process in a different culture, a different language, and come back a much better person.
Well, I'm a governor of another school not far away, actually, Clifton College, and these terrific strengths these institutions have to give breadth of education to a breadth of global citizens is a great advantage. So my final question is, if you could choose to have dinner in a restaurant anywhere in the world, which restaurant would it be and who from the investment world would you like to join you?
I very, very much like to meet David Rubinstein, the founder of Kale. I followed him over the years, and he has done some great interviews. He read lots of books. I don't know how many books he read, but I know he reads a lot of books. And I think he has a very fine mind, a very sharp, very humorous, the kind of people that I think is interesting. And he's single.
Well, that I didn't know.
Single, and he can choose whatever the restaurant he wants to take me. I will be very, very happy to go.
Well, maybe he can come and do a podcast with us afterwards. So that's terrific. Well, Ching, I've learned an enormous amount, and it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you in Shanghai and to help me, but help our listeners understand more of the dynamics that are unfolding in an extraordinarily exciting amphitheater, really, notwithstanding many of the questions and tensions that are there. But investing is a tricky business. So I think you've helped a lot of us understand much more than we did at the beginning.
Thank you for having me, Simon.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.